Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, and we've got a show for you. This week's guest, David Jennings, WJ6W. And David is here to talk all about the AM side of ham radio. And we are here, QSO Live. And let's see here. I've got my co-host here.
And good evening to you, sir.
All right. That's David, KG4WXW. And our guest tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to sit here and talk for 15 minutes about the news. I'm just going to get right to it, because this guy here, if you're an AM radio enthusiast of any kind, if you're a ham radio enthusiast, period, you're just going to be drooling by the time we get off the radio program with him. David Jennings is with us, WJ6W. And I'm just going to let him kind of give you a little bit about his background, because this is really interesting. We just saw some pictures of his home studio. And just asking what kind of console that was that you had there.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm a Collins enthusiast, Collins Radio Company, and this is a Collins Radio 212E1. It's a two-channel console, but it's not stereo. It just has 2 meters, 2 channels, and 9 pots on a 9 mixer controls.
Well, you know, the Collins broadcast equipment, it kind of went through let me say this. There was a similarity between the Collins consoles and the older RCA consoles.
Mm.
And then later, do you remember the old RCAs that were, I guess I want to say, brush chrome looking? And they usually, for some reason, were painted blue on the top.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then came Autogram, Ernie Ankley's line of consoles, which I love those, but I like the older Collins consoles and whatnot that had the Dave and Potts in them. I always thought that those were the coolest things on the planet.
Yeah, well, I remember those. I installed one at a station back in the Midwest where I worked, and I have a friend who restores all this stuff, and he has. Well, he used to have numerous of them. I'm not sure, but I'm sure he has one or two of the RCAs left, but he has all kinds of them. But you're right. The Collins uses the Dave and Potts, and they use the RCA knobs, so that look is the same. And I think internally, I don't know the internal architecture of the RCA that well, but I think it's probably a little bit different for the Collins.
Yeah, I don't know, but I know the old vintage consoles, they had a certain sound to them, you know, and mm-hmm. a couple of the stations that I remember working for when I first started, they use these little Clevite brush headsets. Have you ever seen one of those? They go on one ear, and they sound like a, you know, like piezoelectric or crystal or something.
Yeah.
They're not very loud.
High impedance headsets, I think. Yeah, I've seen them. Probably used one. I don't recall.
Well, I know if you left one on your ear very long, when you took it off, even though they didn't play loud, I mean, they had no volume to them at all, but when you took them off, your ear kind of felt numb, you mm-hmm. know, in a certain frequency range. You know, it just kind of... It just kind of, like looking at a bright light, I guess, is probably what
I think
you call
it. It was sort of like just a telephone element from the air or something, pretty limited.
Now, let me ask you a question. As you're talking now and feeding the audio to us, are you using that RCA mic at this moment?
Absolutely. I'm using the RCA mic and the Collins console. And let's see, nothing else vintage, I guess, in the stream, but that's, it is all, it's tube type. You should be hearing that warm tube sound, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, because that does have the sound of a ribbon mic.
Mm-hmm.
And for the folks, obviously, that can't see on shortwave, he is in front of an RCA, is a 7070X or is it DX77? I always get it messed up.
77DX. That's correct.
Yeah, and those have now. There was another one that I saw that was used a lot in radio stations, and I said, was it something like about 44. Was there a 44 ribbon mic?
Yeah, I have one of those. I guess if we were actually on TV, I'd go and get it and show it to you. But yeah, I have a 44. They weigh about, I would say, about 13 pounds or so. And this 77 weighs, half that, maybe less.
Well, I know they used to mount them on pedestals with counterweights.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You'd stand in front of that mic and... Of course, you'd have to learn how to, cup your hand behind your ear or whatever it was they did back in those days. But
The Gary, what's his name on, who did that?
Owens. Gary Owens.
Gary Owens, yeah. He was a very popular disc jockey out here. And then he got national fame on Laugh-In. And he always used, I believe it was a 44 microphone and cupped his ear so that...
What do you think the difference is? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Sometimes when we're talking back and forth, it's not like totally duplex. I hear a pause, and then all I realize that you're still talking. What do you think sonically the difference is between the 44 and the 77?
Well, I can't hear myself a lot of difference. I have recorded my voice on both of them, and... I would say the 44 is probably has more body to it, maybe a little bit more lower end or smoother. I think ribbons, at least these vintage of ribbons, all kind of suffer from they suffer from being extremely flat. So you really need to equalize them to make them sound good for today's tastes. But I think the 44 probably has a little bit more broader range, sounds a little smoother, but to my ear, it's pretty hard to tell the difference.
Well, I know a couple of times I've hooked up a 77 and I've had fellows say, well, where's the bass? I thought these things really had a lot of bottom. And I said, well, not really. They have, they're just, very even tempered. I mean, you would put them in a recording studio to record an instrument. And they'd give you a pretty good reproduction of that sound. I mean, I've seen people mic mm-hmm. all kinds of instruments with them. And,
yes.
I know they used to at the, on the Opry, on WSM and the Grand Ole Opry, they would have one of those on a floor stand. And they'd have a whole combo gather around with instruments. And mm-hmm. It seems like there's an adjustment on them that will allow them to pick up and one direction or 360 degrees or something like that. Now, you're probably going to tell me all about that.
Yeah, the 77, definitely. It has a diaphragm, I guess it's called, that you can move into the backside of the microphone that will then reject sound from the rear side of the microphone to some degree. It's nothing like today's directional microphones, but you do get some rejection from the back, and it definitely changes the character of the microphone more than just rejection. The whole sound of it changes to me. That's the way I operate this one, so I don't get much reflection off the equipment that's behind the microphone here. And I think it sounds best to my ear that way. But it has this, as I said, this diaphragm, and you can then... change it so that it's omnidirectional, so that isn't in the way in the back. And you can do a figure eight as well, and I forget physically how that happens, but it is a pretty versatile microphone from its day.
Now, I know on the bottom of the DX77, on the very very bottom, there is a flathead, looks like screwdriver adjustment. Or maybe it would be on the top, I guess, depending on which way you've got the microphone.
Which way it's oriented.
And
yeah, that's a response adjustment.
It seemed like there were three positions, but I don't remember what they were. It seems like, I just can't remember. I remember it being there, and I remember it seems like if you turned that control, it would roll the bottom off.
Yeah, there's three positions. It's M, V1, and V2, and I think M is music, V1 is voice 1 and V2 is voice 2. And I wish I could tell you what the differences were. I just leave it on M. So.
Well, I mean, these are wonderful old vintage microphones. If someone is lucky enough to have one and has the microphone was taken care of. However, I do understand, and I may be wrong, that there's a couple fellows out there that specialize in rebuilding those things.
Yeah, there's one out here in Pasadena, and I had my 44. I bought a 44, and it really, the ribbon was shot. So I had him redo it, and it's just beautiful. And he cleaned it up some and sold me a base for it that looks exactly like the original, same quality of build and everything. Not cheap, but did an excellent job. So that's a gentleman out here who builds copies of the RCA mics and then his own version of ribbon mics. And that's his business, is selling new mics that he manufactures. But he does do rebuilding as well.
That's interesting to know that that somebody like that is there, because I don't know. I mean, now I've got a couple of 77s, but I haven't used them. I've always kept them in a box. You know, it's like I'm going to keep these safe. You know, but really, now that I'm getting older, I should pull them out of the box and hook them up. Maybe use them on the broadcast that I do on the shortwave. I'm using currently using the Heil PR40s, and we really like those for broadcast. But boy, it would sure be cool to use one of the 77s. Now, I take it that you also use. Now, here's where we're going to go with this. You use this on amateur radio because you're an AM enthusiast. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because we have a lot of listeners that tune in that are new to ham radio. And somebody says AM, and they're like, well, what are you talking about here? So why don't you get into that? Isn't it strange? Years ago, we used to have to explain what sideband was. Now we have to explain what AM is.
So,
I mean, you might want to get into that a little bit, because that's a side of the hobby that's a corner all of its own. And I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, it is definitely a specialty in the hobby. And there's really only a few frequencies across the country that are used for AM. And the most prominent ones are on 80 meters. Out here in the West Coast, we're on 3870. That's our kind of home frequency. And then further east, 3880, 3885. Maybe occasionally 3890, but I think it's 3880, 3885 mostly. Sometimes we work those guys on the East Coast, depending on conditions. But that's kind of where we hang out. On 40 meters, there's really one frequency that I'm aware of. That's 7293, 7295, right there. And on 20 meters, 14286, and I don't know how active that is. I haven't been on there in a long time. But a lot of us here on the West Coast are on 3870, and the range of equipment is pretty amazing. I use a broadcast transmitter, an old Collins 20V2. That's a 1 kilowatt transmitter. I have throttled back.
I saw that picture, folks. If you go to QRZ and look up his call, WJ6W, you will see in the upper right-hand corner, if you click on that, you will see that Collins 20V. And I guess that runs the 4400s, at least that's best I can remember, you know. But go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you, but I just want folks to be able to see this thing.
Yeah, well, it runs, as you said, it runs 4400s finals, modulated by a pair of 4400s. And the power supply on that used mercury vapor tubes, which I don't use anymore, mainly because I can't put the transmitter's too big to have in my shack. It's out in the garage where it's remote controlled. So, unfortunately, I can't look at it. It's so beautiful. But I just choose not to run the mercury vapor rectifiers and run solid state because there's no point. I can't see them do their thing. So the mercury vapors pulsate on modulation, and they were always fun to watch.
They pulsate blue. This blue, yes. Wonderful looking blue color. That's ionization inside there, mm-hmm. but. In the broadcast transmitters, I'm sure you're familiar with the 8008s.
I'm not.
That's a large mercury vapor rectifier.
Oh, 8008. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the two.
There wasn't
right.
there also a 575 mercury vapor rectifier?
I think that's the one that the my transmitter uses.
Okay, I remember those two. And then, of course, in the small... transmitters like in Heathkit built these amps, the HA-10s, they put 866s mm-hmm. in those. And I guess the 866s were in a lot of smaller 100-watt transmitters.
Mm-hmm. I think the low voltage on this transmitter had 866s too, but that's converted to solid state, if I remember right. Now, I could be wrong on that. But anyway, yeah, it's a really neat transmitter, and... In our group, there are several people running Collins transmitters. I'm having a brain freeze here on the other models, but there's various broadcast transmitters on. And as a matter of fact, I have a good friend who you probably know of. That's Mike Durow. You're familiar with a Durow loudness meter.
Anybody that's been in... broadcasting for any length of time. Yeah, plus he's also the creator of the DAP audio processor.
So. Yeah, that's the audio processor I use on my AM transmitters, the DAP 610, which is the digitally controlled one. And I have a couple Durow meters. Anyway, he is a unbelievable collector of broadcast gear and transmitters, and he's converted many of these to 80 meters. And helped a lot of guys out with those. And so he's actually someone you might want to talk to some other time. But he's done a lot of this stuff. And continuing on with the range of equipment we hear on our net, besides the broadcast, there's military gear guys bring up, T-368. Transmitters, they run a 4400. I think their power output range is around 500 watts, maybe 400, 300. Then there's the real amateur radio stuff made by Heathkit or Hammerlin. Hallicrafters didn't make really AM that I'm aware of.
The Johnson Viking.
Vikings, yeah.
Yeah, the Heathkit... what was it? The 100.
DX100.
That's it. I'm getting like... You're listening to the QSL Radio Show. We'll be right back with our guest, David Jennings, WJ6W, right after this. You've heard us talk about the CC Skywave Radio. And the only way you can do this radio justice is you have to hold one in your hand. You have to own it. You have to be able to take it out in the backyard or slip it in your pocket as you travel around. It's a beautiful travel radio. Probably the best travel radio that you could possibly ever want to own. Okay, it's got AM on it, a very hot AM radio section. FM, FM stereo. It's got Weather Alert Plus. It's also got the shortwave bands, 2.3 to 26.1 megahertz continuous tuning. And it also has the air aviation band. You have direct entry of frequencies and plus auto scan and store. Can you believe that? A lighted LCD display, selectable fast or fine tuning on all bands except weather. There are 400 memory presets on this radio, and it runs on two AA alkaline batteries, all right? And it runs forever. There's a stereo headphone jack and a fold-out backstand. Of course, you've seen those. The clock with 12 or 24-hour format. The alarm that's on it as well. And there's a rotary volume knob, which is kind of cool. I hate the knobs you have to push on them, you know, and turn the volume up and down. It comes with high-quality CC buds, the earphones, and a carrying case along with a one-year warranty. Now, you can order the SkyWave radio right now. To order, all you have to do is call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863, or visit them at ccrane.com. You have to mention WTWW. And the reason why we want you to do that is Bob Crane wants to know that you're supporting him as he brings you Midnight in the Desert, the Art Bell Show, as well as some of the music programming we have here on WTWW. Once again, the phone number 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863, or go to ccrane.com and be sure and mention WTWW. Here at QSL, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger, but you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from the QSO radio show and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSORadioshow.com website. R&L Electronics. Now listen, go to their website and look at what they've got. Talk about ideas. They've got towers, radio accessories. They have HF radios, VHF radios, UHF radios. They've got power supplies. They've got connectors. They've got coax and cable. They've got books on amateur radio. They've got amateur radio tuners, antenna tuners, I should say, automatic and manual. They've got antenna mounts. They've got all sorts of antenna accessories, along with antennas themselves. And they also have big amplifiers, and they have medium-sized amplifiers, and they've got preamps, and they've got used equipment, and they've got all the major brand names like Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Alinco, you name it. It's all there at R&L Electronics. Now, another thing, they carry used items. Radios that have been previously owned that are in mint condition. They've got the new Yaesu System Fusion Mobile. Their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. Now, I'll give that to you in just a minute. But just remember, folks are happy when they deal with R&L Electronics. They're great on service. They're courteous. They get the item out quickly to you. And if you have any problems at all, these folks are right on top of it. Now, once again, their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. 1-800-221-7735. Or go to Google and just Google R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. And mention WTWW when you call.
It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right now.
It's the CR1A. Now you say, what's the CR1A? CR1A is a software-defined radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this thing does not need a computer. It's totally self-contained. And it's a little bitty toot. It sets on the desktop. As far as ham radio is concerned, it does 160 through 10. International broadcast bands, it does 120 through 11 AM single sideband CW. I can't get into all of the features, but for example, on VHF, it goes from 64 to 260 megahertz. UHF from 437 to 512. FM broadcast band. Oh my goodness. I don't want to try to describe this radio. You have to see it. It does the aircraft band. There's a Marine and NOAA. It does the public service bands. It's a software defined radio without the computer. It's self-contained and it's small. It's slick looking. And you just have to check it out. Check out the CR1A. Comm Radio. Go to commradio.com. That's C-O-M-M radio. Comm Radio, one word, .com. Check out the CR1A. And when you contact them, mention WTWW.
Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, David Jennings, WJ6W.
Trying to can't think. But in the broadcast arena, though, there's still a lot of gates, kilowatt transmitters sitting around. There's RCAs. Matter of fact, I don't know if you remember, but RCA made a 500 watt and a 1,000. The 1,000 was like the 1,000M. Mm-hmm. Or no, it was called the 1M. And I don't remember what the 500 watt was, but they ran 833As, which are mm-hmm. really an impressive tube if you see them hanging inside of a transmitter cabinet.
Yeah, they kind of hang on a wall inside.
And the audio coming off of those, I'll tell you, we had a radio station in the Nashville area, and it was actually it was in Brentwood, Tennessee. And we went and picked up two old 1Ms. And brought them back. One had been fire damaged, and the other one was supposedly working. So we went inside and did what you normally do, check all values of things and replace stuff that's obvious, and put that one 1M on the air
And we were on 560 here in Nashville. And that thing, it sounded like a jukebox on the air. I mean, it just sounded wonderful. It had such a, the audio on it. I mean, and later on, I had a chance to compare it to a new solid state transmitter. And the solid state transmitter just, it just didn't sound as good. It was brittle sounding, you know. And then later, I don't know if you've ever seen a Bauer 707.
Yeah, that was when I forgot. I was trying to think of the Bauer 707. There's several guys with them out here.
Well, the Bauer 707, we had one. We rebuilt it, the boys and I. We bought another 707 off of a country music performer, Ernie Ashworth, who was a member of the Grand Ole Opry. And he liked to buy small AM stations, you know, and then try to resell them. But he came across this Bauer 707, and I bought it off of him. So we had a parts stash where we could grab parts from. And we rebuilt this Bauer. And boy, did it sound good! And we had a new solid state at that time. There was a transmitter that had come out that had kind of been making the circuit. The Omnitronics was the name of it, and we thought it sounded pretty good. But turn that old Bauer on, and the Bauer just sounded better. I mean, it just sounded more mellow. Something I don't know. I guess it's just something, you know. So these older broadcast transmitters for ham radio. Let me ask you this. If a guy was to procure one, matter of fact, I have a McMartin that runs 400 A's that we need to go pick it up. We loaned it. We loaned it to an AM station during a flood, and we were having all kind of problems getting it tuned, and had a fella come in to help us, Kevin Kidd, who runs a AM, I guess I want to say AM ground systems. He puts in a lot of ground systems and does that. He came in, we retuned it, and we didn't have a crystal for the oscillator, so we took a Yaesu 757 GX and squeaked the output up on a frequency meter till we had enough. Performed flawlessly. It got us through until the flood was over with, and their normal. Transmitter was back on the air. I was going to say,
oh, interesting, yeah.
So, how, you know, you and Mike Durow could write a book on this, I'm sure. But how difficult is it for the average guy to take an old broadcast transmitter from a radio station and go inside there and retune it into the amateur section of the frequency range?
Well, if you know what you have to do physically, it's not that bad, really. Luckily, we have the Collins. There's a Collins radio organization that is dedicated to preserving all this old Collins gear. And one of the members, one of the leading members, was an engineer, a very knowledgeable RF engineer, and he worked out all the details of converting the Collins equipment to 80 meters and possibly 40. 160 is almost trivial, I guess. But anyway, he published some very good information about that. And basically, it's going to the tank circuit and removing some of the coils and changing the capacitance around a bit. And changing the RF choke, because that will resonate, unfortunately, on 80 meters and burn up. So you have to change that. And then you go into the oscillator stage and re-spin some of the tuning coils, two tuning coils for the low level stages. And that's the major part of it. You know, if you're into electronics enough to solder and build things, I think it's something you could take on. But to me, it's way more fun because it's bigger, you know, like dealing with the bigger stuff. The procedure for other transmitters is somewhat similar, because other than tube types, the basic concept of how the transmitter works is the same from one manufacturer to the other, at least in those days, high-level modulation and so on. One of our members was just learning about electronics, and he got broadcast rig, and he just played with it till it worked, basically. He didn't know from really what he was doing, other than some general guidance, kind of like what I just described. And he was able to, by trial and error, get it working, and he has one of the best-sounding signals on the air right now.
Well, you know, I tuned in a couple of times. I go into the AM window and listen, you know. I've got one friend of mine from out east, Jamie Labadia, who's a broadcast engineer, travels all over the world building shortwave transmitters from scratch. And he kept on me. He said, well, you need to get into the AM window. You need to get... So I was really surprised when I was listening to a bunch of guys talking, and the conversation was extremely interesting. But I thought, you know, I don't have a plate modulated rig. If I was to check in here, I'd get laughed out of the arena, you know. And so I can't remember what rig I had. I can't remember now. But I put it on AM and I threw out my call. And guy come back to me. We were talking. I said, well, I don't have a plate modulated rig, and he said, oh, well, you sound just fine. You know, they made me feel extremely welcome, even though I felt very self-conscious over my you know, simulated AM amateur radio transceiver.
Yeah, well, we get a lot of guys checking in on their sideband rigs, and we're very polite with them, and they can sound very acceptable. They don't have the broad frequency range that the plate modulated rigs do, but they can sound pretty decent. And if they can generate a little bit of power, then they're very copyable. Usually you can't really run more than about 25 watts out of a standard 100 watt sideband rig on AM. So it's good to have a little amplification after it. And that helps a lot. But I'll tell you, one of the modern rigs that can sound, be almost indistinguishable from a broadcast rig if set right, is the Flex Radio. It's pretty astounding what that can do. I think you can set the audio bandwidth on that to, who knows, 20 kilohertz or something. But it they can sound very, very good.
Well, you know, of course, now Flex has had, I've heard so many people talk about the versatility of the Flex receivers. You know, of course, I've not heard anything much about the transmitters, but that makes sense, because you could really define exactly what you wanted to have happen in terms of the software, and it's going to respond that way. You know, of the other radios that are out there, let me ask this question: older rigs that have an AM position on them, that say are tube rigs, how acceptable are things like the heat? Well, I guess I'm thinking some of the Heathkits don't have AM positions on them, but the Drakes did. All the Drake TR4Cs and TR, even going back to the TR3. How bad of an AM rig are those things?
Well, they would be. I don't know what the bandwidth is, but it wouldn't. You certainly wouldn't appreciate what I would be transmitting. Let's put it that way. I don't really know what the bandwidth is.
Well, the reason why I ask is that I've seen these AM filters sold for them. Or you can put and I don't know how wide they are. I can't remember now, but they were...
Well, they might be 6 kilohertz, which isn't bad. If you can get wider, you can hear these broadcast rigs better, you know, as far as quality.
Now, see, sticking in my mind, it seems like I have seen a Drake AM filter 10 kilohertz wide.
Oh, really? No,
I haven't.
Well,
that
would be
ages.
Excellent.
But, you know what? Oh, I know what that was used for now. I'm sorry. I was just thinking. That was used by a bunch of Citizens Band enthusiasts that were interested in putting the TR4s on Citizens Band. That's what that was. Now, I remember. And they were 10 kilohertz.
The transmitter?
Oh, the filter. The filter. Oh,
the filter in the transmitter?
Or? Yeah, the AM filter. Well, it's a transceiver, you know, so I mean...
Wow. So well, I don't know how really that would sound with the rest of the electronics and so on. I'd be very skeptical of that.
Well, see, but those guys, I remember on Citizens Band, one of the big complaints they had was that the sideband filters, when they went to AM... the sideband filter, or the filter that came with the radio, Mm-hmm. Everybody sounded like they had a cold.
Yeah, yeah. That filter would be 2.4 kilohertz or possibly less. At the best, maybe 2.8. So that really isn't too pleasant to use on AM. It's fine for sideband. It's perfect for sideband, but wouldn't be too good on AM. I wanted to mention that my receivers, I've got a Hammerland SP600, which is my favorite AM receiver, and it has a selectivity range. Well, the narrowest is down in almost CW levels, but the ones I use for AM is 3, 8, and sometimes 13 kilohertz wide. And when the conditions are right and you have a strong station, that radio just sounds wonderful. It's the best AM receiver I know of.
I had a Hammerland HQ170 and an HQ180. Yeah. And I was astounded at the audio on those because it seems those were general coverage. But I can hear, and with shortwave stations especially, the audio was just incredible. Go ahead.
I listen to WTWW on this Hammerland sometimes too. It's a general coverage. And it sounds very, very good.
So we got to keep our audio clean on this end.
Yeah, yeah, I'll let you know if it isn't. I also have what is a pretty highly sought after Collins 51S1, which is AM and sideband. But its bandwidth is tailored, so it's limited to somewhere in the 5 kilohertz range. And even though it's a very good receiver, it doesn't sound nearly as good as this Hammerland to my ears. So, you know, receivers are designed a certain way for certain purposes. The Collins was used a lot by the military and built to their specs. And the Hammerland was built for military also, but I think they needed the wide bandwidth for things like RTTY or something. But it works out very well for AM.
Well, I had a Hallicrafters SX100, then I had the 101 later. Mm-hmm. I had to have the 101. It was just like, I don't know, the thing. It was just so impressive looking, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wasn't quite as thrilled with it as I thought I would be. It was a good receiver, don't get me wrong. But the first time I ever saw amateur radio demonstrated was a fellow in Dearborn, Michigan. His name was Nelson Cosby. And Nelson, of course, has since passed on. But he had an SX-101 Heathkit Marauder and his own homebrew version of an 813 amp and a 20-meter beam on a tower. And he, the first contact I ever saw was him talking to a guy in Denver from Dearborn Heights, Michigan. And he was using that SX-101. So, of course, as a kid, after I saw that, you know, that was the goal. I had to have one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I noticed that all the Hallicrafters receivers, and I'm not saying a word bad about them, it seemed like the Hammerland had a more musical sound in the receiver. As you're tuning in music or a broadband signal, it just seemed like the fidelity was there, you know.
Yeah.
Where the Hallicrafters sounded more like a communications receiver. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
Well, I think I agree with that. I do really like this Hammerland. It is a broadcast receiver, in my opinion. And one of the reasons is for the sound, apparently, is the output stage uses a 6V6 tube. It's single-ended. You know, the real purists say it needs to be a push-pull circuit for the best sound, but meaning two tubes in the output. But it has a 6V6 out of it, which is a very audiophile-like tube. And it sounds great. The Hallicrafters, the only one I have is a sideband receiver with AM on it, and it does have that communication sound. You can't really compare the two, in my opinion, either.
Yeah, that's interesting. Although Hallicrafters is a legendary name in amateur radio gear.
Well, they make excellent sideband gear, and like I said, I have a transmitter receiver, which isn't in the lineup right now, but it uses I'm losing the term. But anyway, it's a has a pretty good sound on the sideband.
Now you're not thinking of the HT37 with the phasing.
Yeah, it's a phasing rig. Yeah, that was the word I was looking for.
No.
Yeah, this one is a phasing rig that I have. Let's see. Let me, if you'll give me a moment. yeah, I have an SX-117 receiver.
Oh, yeah. That was a real cool radio. And it was the front on that was old.
It's an HT44 transmitter.
Okay, yeah. Those are matching, aren't they?
Yeah.
I
think they were the kind of the competitor, their competition or their version of to compete with the Collins S-Line transmitter. They kind of had a rounded look to them. They were taller and far cheaper, far less expensive, so affordable for many more hams. But they were, I think they were kind of what Hallcrafters put out in competition with the Collins at the time.
Well, I remember the 117 because it didn't take, width-wise, it didn't take up as much real estate as the 101, and the dial mm-hmm. was like circular as opposed to slide rule, you know, right-left. If I'm remembering, mm-hmm. if I'm not, correct
me. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it is circular on my rigs. I think the other one was slide rule. You know, I kind of like slide rules, though. They look neat.
Well, the 117 though was definitely a premium receiver, a preferred mm-hmm. receiver over so many. You know, and I was I guess I want to say I was so young I couldn't afford any of that stuff. You know, I was I looked at it. Then later, as I got older, you know, I'd pick a piece up here and there, you know, used. But by then, everybody was, you know, thumbing their nose at the technology. I just wish I would have saved as many of the radios
yeah.
as I swapped out and, you know, and traded. Well, let me ask you this question. Now, you have a background in engineering. Now, is this? I think if I remember right, was I was reading as you've been doing. You did television engineering,
right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm a television systems engineer. And I've been doing that since, well, actually, I'll back up. When I was a kid, I was getting interested in ham radio. And then my grandmother took me to the local radio station in Iowa, where we lived. And they had all this cool Collins equipment. Collins is made in Iowa. So they had all this cool stuff. And I thought, wow, that is great. And, of course, I like the disc jockey thing. That was the first thing on my mind, but the technology I really liked. And so I lost interest in ham radio, got into broadcasting, and then only later got interested again in ham radio. But I've been in broadcasting since high school, actually, and I'm getting close to retirement now, so it's a long time.
Well, tell me something. I've got my son sitting here, David, who is, I guess I want to say, in charge of all things video at mm-hmm. Tribeca Nazarene University. And I know that, well, of course, now I've got a younger son that works with Dave Ramsey. And goodness, the both of them came in and put in all kinds of stuff in this studio, all this HD, everything. And I'm kind of lost, but I was going to say, why don't you talk a little bit about what's happened with television since the time you started and up until now? What changes have you seen? I mean, it's kind of like in radio describing a turntable and a cart machine and a CD player and, you know, and now everything on hard drive. What have you seen? What challenges have there been with television engineering? And I kind of like for him to speak about a little bit what he's doing and see if any of it chimes.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, I'm preserving all this. I'm trying to preserve all the stuff I remember from when I first got into broadcasting. Like you say, the turntables, the cart machines, the tube type mixers and all that. So that's that was at the era that I entered the business. And Then I went to, after high school, I went to engineering school, Iowa State University, and I picked up some part-time work at the local, well, at the station. There was a commercial station owned by the university, commercial TV station and radio. So I was a board engineer and a transmitter engineer and so on. And that's at the point when tubes were pretty far along in being eliminated. And we were going from, well, when I first got into television, there were videotape machines with 2-inch wide tape that was, that each tape machine would be, let's say, 5 racks of equipment, all tubes. 5 racks of tubes. There must be hundreds of tubes. I really don't know because that's too far back and I didn't know much about it then. So that was where I entered the field, and it was rapidly changing to solid state equipment. So things got much, much smaller, consumed a lot less power, generated a lot less heat, but we still had the 2-inch tape for many years. Then, that was always very interesting. It required a lot of mechanics to keep it going, and the operator had to be fairly skilled to play. Each tape had to be adjusted on the machine to play back properly because the consistency of recording from various other suppliers, other stations and whatnot, wasn't always that good. So every tape was kind of had to be uniquely adjusted. And then we got into more automated playback where things were more consistent, where the machines would load themselves and set themselves up. Then we went to 1-inch tape, which was a very high quality improvement. It went from what was called quadruplex to helical type scanning. And that's when things like freeze frame and slow motion became possible. And I'm just describing really a small part of what was happening in the business. That became the standard. And then smaller formats came along, the cassettes that everyone is familiar with, their old VHS or whatever they had. There's broadcast versions of that that came along. It offered even more capability and shrunk the size and weight and power down dramatically. Then the next revolution was that became digital tape, and that that improved the quality and the reproducibility. In other words, you could make many copies, many generations of copies on digital, whereas an analog, after 4 or 5 copy generations, the picture may not hardly be recognizable, depending on the skill of the operators. But once we went to digital, we're into the almost unlimited generation. Depth of generation, which allowed editing to become extremely sophisticated, where you could redo and redo and redo and redo and get all the effects you could imagine at the time without losing quality. From there, the trend became someone realized that computers were almost powerful enough to be able to record, edit, and play back the videos. I say almost because you're able to do it, but it was extremely painful. The computers were not fast enough. The software wasn't sophisticated enough. It was very painful, but we persevered and knew that this was, the trend that's going to happen. So that developed over time. And basically, once the computerized editing was perfected, the old ways of editing with tape and large computers controlling several tape machines, shuttling back and forth and so on, that went away, and it's all now contained in computers. And they're more powerful than the old tape machine systems ever were, and they can do far, far more in the way of creative effects and so on. I think we're at the point now where almost anything you can imagine can be achieved with the computer editing and computer painting of videos and animations and so on. Then, of course, we've gone to high definition from standard. When I first started in television, many people across the country, especially in rural areas, lived with a snowy picture, and they thought it was good. But they lived with snowy pictures that faded in and out depending on the propagation conditions, especially Channel 2 in the summer. I don't know if you remember those days.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, then in the year 2000, approximately, was it 2000 or I can't remember the year now, but we changed all to digital, and that again was another sea change in the transmission, of course, and the quality received at home. The quality at home received is not nearly as good as you might see in the studio, but so much superior to what it used to be that it's very worthwhile doing. So we've gotten to that point, and I guess the next steps are twice the resolution, 3D, which didn't really take off, but Ultra HD, which is upcoming. And that's going to be a challenge for broadcasters to transmit. That may go the way of the internet or something, some other method we might supplant broadcasting on that. But, unfortunately but for me, but
we're already to the point where we're seeing the pores in a person's nose. I mean, you're seeing nasal hair. You're seeing hair in the ears and little blemishes on the face. Why do we want to go any deeper into this?
That's kind of my question too. I'm not in a big rush to get a 4K television. That's the upcoming thing.
Now I can see scenery. You know, when you're looking at a still, you know, where you're looking at pictures of a still body of water or lake or ocean and. You know, outside in nature, I can see that increased resolution would probably look really cool, but I don't know, on a television talk show?
To get that picture to home requires a lot of compression, digital compression, which means throwing away 90% of the picture to get it through the transmitter pipe or the internet or whatever to your home, and then it needs to be reconstructed, and that is definitely not perfect. So going to these really ultra high resolutions, until we can get more bandwidth and better compression, I don't know how good it'll be. I'm not really in that part of the business of the transmission area and compression and so on. They've done amazing things with it, so they probably will come up with some more amazement. But it just keeps moving on.
Oh, the compression algorithms that are used just for audio, you know, MP3 now. Well, what's AAC and what's I don't know, but they're still. I don't care with all of those. I can still hear a difference between those and linear sound.
Oh yeah,
and,
absolutely.
A lot of folks say, "Oh no, I can't," but. If you've got a really good pair of speakers and a turntable, now I have I'm just saying that what level that we're at here, I don't have a top end turntable. I have a Rega P3 with an RB300 tone arm and the exact Rega phono cartridge on it and going into a Carver preamp and then into a good basic amp. Well, I've got two or three around here. But into some vintage speakers like Dahlke's DQ10s or some Acoustats or something like that. And, I mean, if you take, I don't care how or what format it is, the AAC format or the highest bitrate MP3, and you play that through that system, it's a sonic horror show is what it is.
Mm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, analog, there's something about that, you know. Now, how has that affected television? I mean, you talk analog, there's no way in the world that you could do high definition analog television.
No, no.
I don't.
Well, there was a standard. Japanese did it first. They did the first high definition. I believe that was an analog standard. And I don't know the details of it. I'm guessing that their channel bandwidth was wider than their standard definition was. But now everyone's gone digital, and that's really the only way it worked long term.
Well, I don't know, but you've kind of ran the gamut, though. You've been through the whole thing. So, David, where are you at in terms of what you're doing with? He does all these sports, and I know at the Dave Ramsey Studios, I'd have to ask what kind of cameras and things, but I remember they were the first ones in Nashville, actually, to go HD. Mm-hmm. They were doing HD before Larry King was doing it, because his engineers... Mm. Well, anyways, David, you talk a little bit about this, because this video stuff's over my head.
I like to describe my setup as the ugliest TV install a radio engineer has done. So, I mean, it is quite the hodgepodge of a setup. But no, I'm doing I do live video for primarily for internet and for our sporting events and concerts and whatnot. But I've got an amazing student body team that helps me do all of this stuff. So our games are, we've got like 12 kids that are doing all kinds of things. I got them running. Audio, got people on the floor, dodging basketball players as they're running around. And, we're doing everything there. We do it all HD. We're running some Panasonic cameras with SDI out. And, in talking about everything getting smaller, I'm running all of this stuff on a small computer, at a homebrew build box and using these Blackmagic video capture cards. And by golly, I mean, these things, they are small. I look at some of this Blackmagic stuff, and you can fit a whole giant console, a whole video console, what would have taken up half a room as far as an analog console, into a 2RU rack, 2RU mm-hmm. rack mount piece. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's wild seeing how all of this is... has transpired, because I've got a couple of old video consoles, and they are huge.
We've got a listener who has emailed in, and we haven't even plugged the email address, but he's emailed in, and Holly's got it over here on the phone. Why don't you either you read it or David read it? I don't know if it's did you text it to David? I guess so. We're relaying email through text messages, along with some reception reports. Okay, we love those. I just, I'll tell you, it blows my mind to sit here at a shortwave radio station and be on the air and hear, get signal reports coming in from all over the country and all over the world, really.
All right. Okay. We got a K2LCT in Phoenix, Arizona. His question is, do you have any ideas where TV to cell phones are going?
Well, streaming to all kinds of mobile devices is really exploding. As a matter of fact, I'll just describe. I'm a consulting engineer, but for the last year and a half, most of my time has been spent. I'm getting a little tongue-tied here. Most of my time has been spent at the Fox Television Network Center in West Los Angeles on the Fox movie lot, and they originate around, I think it's 14 or 12 cable channels, the Fox network, and bunches of sports networks. And they're starting to feel the pressure of people moving away from watching TV and watching things streamed on their phone, on their tablet, their computer, and it's really starting to affect the business, and in a dramatic way. And that's not good from our perspective, unless, of course, the networks, the originators have to step up and compete with that and move towards this streaming model. I don't know if that does that address the question.
I think so. You know, I'll tell you, I'm battling with the same thing over there at Trevecca right now. The we've sent out a couple of surveys, and of course our we've got, you know, plenty of dorm rooms and administration buildings and whatnot, and we've got our local provider gives us a digital signal, and then we basically have our own little head end in there, and we take the digital, send it out to the various main buildings. Every television in there has to have a box, one of these horrible, ugly looking wall wart things dangling from a television. Now, the dorm rooms, they all have analog going to them so that anybody can bring their own television. So, a survey was sent out a while back ago when our contract was coming up, because, you know, the school was looking at how much they're spending on cable TV for everybody. And basically, the survey came back that nobody's watching TV.
Yeah.
You know, so they're all running, you know, these streaming services on their phones and laptops and whatnot. But I am still, you know, as a ham, I'm still a big proponent of having a hard line there at the school. I want to have my local channels. You know, I've heard it before. My father has said it before. You know, when the skies go dark, where do you turn to? You know, mm-hmm. And you're not going to get that from these major cable networks. You're going to get it from your local TV stations that are there on the ground. You know, that's where you're going to get it from. And I try my best to keep reminding people that that's, you know, that's where you're going to get your news.
Yeah, I think that's true. But like you say about younger people, I have a niece who's 30 years old, and I just spent a little time with her up in San Francisco, where she recently moved, and she doesn't have a TV. She does everything on her iPad, watching whatever entertainment and so on. And I that was just verification of what I'm hearing, that the younger people just aren't interested in television. But you're right. For information and help in emergencies, there's no substitute. But we just hope that we all remain around on the air. But it's getting harder.
Well, one of the things I was going to say, and that is that one way it what strikes me, if you are near Wi-Fi, then I can see somebody watching television on their cell phone. That makes sense to me. Get away from Wi-Fi, though, and get on Verizon's service or any of the other services. A lot of them, Verizon will tell you it's unlimited, but believe me, it's not. If you go over five, what is it, five?
I believe it's 5 gigs.
You go over 5 gigs, you got to pull your wallet out and start shucking out the bucks, okay?
That's what they want to hear.
And so I don't believe we're there yet. I think that if your cell phone had unlimited bandwidth, I would say then you're looking at annihilation of television and radio as we know it, okay? But as long as the cell phone companies are in there, charging the money they charge. And, you know, and I'm just doing regular radio engineering where I have to listen to streams that we're putting out. I have to monitor this and that and the other. And I think Holly said I was up to, I don't know what it was, 8 to 12 gigs on my phone.
Yeah, you're kind of crazy with your,
yeah,
your usage.
You know, so, and as I go over that, it's easy. All of a sudden, you know, the cell phone bill goes from what it normally is. We've got a bunch of cell phones on, so our cell phone bill's, you know, well over $200. But if I were to use the phone for entertainment purposes, if I were sitting there watching Netflix on it, you know, or listening to my favorite oldie station or something, my cell phone bill could hit $400 in a heartbeat, you know?
Yeah, I don't think that's practical yet. I mean, I don't know what people are doing, but you can do some of it on the cell phone. Personally, I hate watching anything on the cell phone. It's just too small. I've watched on a tablet a little, but I still prefer a reasonably sized screen television, definitely.
Oh, but there's no question about it. And when you go into the department stores, and you see these gigantic flat screens, and everybody wants one in their house. You know, I don't think the cell phone is a competitor. I'm sorry. You know, you're bored sitting in a doctor's office. Sure, you know, I mean that sounds cool. Or you're in some situation where you're wanting to see a video, and you're stuck in a location where there's no television set. Sure, I think that, you know, that's kind of cool to sit back and watch. And I've got a. I've got a phone I hate. It's a what is this thing? It is a Samsung Galaxy Note 5. Okay, it has a 5-minute battery. All right, and you can't take the battery out and change it. It will charge rapidly, but you're good for 5 minutes. Now I don't know. Actually, in reality, it's got a 3-hour battery in it. I think that's absurd. And yeah. Any cell phone company that would put something out like this, you know, you got engineering people that all their brains leaked out of their ears and onto the floor. Now, I had the Galaxy Note 3. That thing would go all day long and well into the night. I was really happy with the battery life on it. But this thing is worthless. I would not recommend anyone going down this way. But the other, what my point was is watching television and listening to radio is rough on cell phone batteries. In other words, if you already, and most people I know are trying to conserve their batteries, they'll tell you right out the gate, well, if I don't watch it, you know, my phone will be dead by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So I think we got several hurdles to cross. First, battery life.
Battery life is a big one, yeah.
Bandwidth charges and all that. There is just no substitution for a regular full-blown television set. You know, now, you know, notebooks and tablets and all that, that's cool. But I still think it's a no-contest thing when it comes to the big widescreen, flat screens that people are carrying home. And, you know, I wonder how many of them got purchased just before the Super Bowl.
You know? Yeah, I hear people purchase them, and then some people, they purchase them on Saturday and take them back Monday saying they don't like them.
Well, yeah, that price tag is not real encouraging. But what's I guess the thing of it is David, what you're doing, what level is that as compared to what David is working with or knows about? I mean, I know because what you're doing is, I mean, it's way above what it used to be.
Oh, right? Yeah, it's you know, I used to be. My first broadcast was with a broken camera and a computer and a Pinnacle video capture card, and it was all analog. I think it was one of them capture cards you use for recording, you know, your VHS tapes into your computer. I mean, it was just horrible. It was I was doing volleyball. I've greatly increased that to. You know, now I'm doing a 6-camera shoot. I just had ASN, American Sports Network, come in, and it kind of validated my hodgepodge, because they showed up and they did a national broadcast from my facility, and you know, I sat on my hands. You know, I helped them out get everything all set up. I started looking, and they're doing the same stuff I am. You know, they had a whole lot more whistles and bells than I did. You know, I was very happy that, you know, my setup was basically the same thing they were doing.
Yeah, very good, very good. Are you, one of the things I failed to mention is the IT revolution in our business, too. Everything is going that direction, basically. The one of the pushes where I'm working is we have very large number of routing switchers that route to one signal, video signal, from one place to another. We have thousands of ports. And the big push there is to convert that all to something that's basically Ethernet, let's say, and route it that way and collapse this all down to less equipment, more flexibility based on IT. And I cannot tell you how many Cisco routers are at this place, hundreds and hundreds. that keep it on the air. So I just wonder if that's gotten into your area yet, David.
Slowly but surely. I have a TriCaster unit, and I also have an instant replay unit. So all of my cameras are hooked up to. I'm using all of the inputs on the TriCaster. However, it does have a couple of net inputs. So I'm not entirely sure the protocol that it's running, but my instant replay deck, he can push video over to me via the network. And, of course, I can do that from anywhere on campus. Another feature that I'm getting ready to play with is one of my student workers came up with a crazy idea. You know, sports, you know, especially more work for me. But anyways, she has an iPad, and we're going to make the attempt of sending video from her iPad over Wi-Fi and into my system to go over the broadcast. So that means
live?
Yes, live. So that means during the halftime. So the idea is doubleheader, you know, men's and women's or women's and men's game. Halftime of the women's game, she's going to go down to the location where everybody's getting their face painted up for the men's game. You know, so and do like a, you know, a little reporting live on the scene type scenario. She's got it all figured out.
That's pretty cool. That's really neat. Yeah.
So, you know, she her mother had gotten to her this whole setup for her iPad, you know, some thing for her to hold it, a Rode microphone on it. It's got the lighting kit on it and everything. So,
yeah, well, I guess as long as you can keep a strong Wi-Fi signal, it should work, huh?
That's what we're hoping for.
I'm a real enemy of Wi-Fi, and that is, it just seems like it's never consistent. You know, it's okay for checking email, and other than that, you know, to me it's a headache. It's a migraine headache.
Well, you know, this computer I'm using, for example, I use on ham radio. For ham radio, I should explain what we do on our AM nets. We also stream a video to a site where a bunch of us put up our cameras and we can text each other and look at us sitting at our junk. I do not use Wi-Fi on this computer because of the RFI potential when I'm transmitting. And I think that's paid off. I've never been kicked off the network while transmitting, but some of the guys do, and they're using Wi-Fi on their laptops and whatnot. And whenever they transmit, their picture freezes and they have to start over. So, I like wired stuff yet.
Let me just go back in time a ways here. You were talking a little bit about your beginnings in ham radio, but you just kind of brushed on it. I guess I'd like to ask, when is the first time that you ever heard the term ham radio, or was acquainted with it, or even knew that it existed and what it was? I'm curious as to how that came about.
Well, I guess it had to be in the 60s. I recall listening. My dad had one of those, Zenith console radios that was almost as tall as I was, and had shortwave on it. And I recall tuning across that and picking up stations. Must have been AM, obviously. And I don't know if I heard the term ham radio, but somehow, in listening to that, I became acquainted with Heathkit and ordered one of their catalogs, and of course drooled over that for a long, long time. But that's probably the origins of it, somewhere in there. And I'll have to say that I was very interested in getting a better shortwave radio. So one summer I worked all summer to save $39 to buy a Heathkit GR64 receiver. And I built it, and that was kind of my opening to shortwave radio. But as I said, I kind of got diverted into broadcasting after that. But it was in my teen years sometime.
that GR64 looked a little bit like the Hallicrafter's S120.
Well, you know, I recently bought one of those GR64s at a swap meet, and it didn't work, but I got it working. And I was interested in the S120, and I looked up the schematic on it, and they're very almost the same, actually. So one stole from the other. I'm guessing Heathkit stole it from Hallicrafters, but they're really the same radio. Not a very good radio, but it opened the doors for a lot of people to listen to shortwave.
Well, if you have a big antenna on it, you know, you got a couple of maybe 100 foot of wire hooked up to that thing and a good ground, they did fairly well, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I don't remember how stable. I don't remember how stable they were, but I know. But you know, when you're younger and you're tuning shortwave, you're sitting in front of the radio with your hand on the knob anyways, you know, so you're your mm-hmm. own AFC, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've listened recently on it. It's sitting behind me here. I've listened to WTWW on it recently. So, and let's see, I only had to retune it every 20 minutes or so after it warmed up. Maybe half hour.
Well, I hope when you were younger that you did not build an Ico 753 tri-bander.
I've heard about that. No, I think I saw one given away at a swap meet.
That well, you know, they only sold for it was a three band transceiver, put out a little bit more than 100 watts.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like there were sweep tubes in the final, and I built a kit. I built one, and they drifted. But my goodness, I mean, for $179 for a single sideband transceiver with CW on it. And I can't remember if it had AM. It may have had AM. I don't know. But
Speaking of kits, if you don't mind, I wanted to go back. And did you know that the Bauer broadcast transmitter was a kit?
Originally, it was the one that we had here in Tennessee.
Yeah.
Was built by, not an engineer, but it was built by the station owner.
Hmm.
And The thing came in, and he worked on it until he had it assembled. He was a little different kind of a radio station owner. But that's the only reason I would have ever known that, was because somebody told me. They said, well, you know, that originally that was a kit, and he built it. His name was Chester Davis. He was famous.
That's kind of familiar.
He was famous for driving in traffic while reading the newspaper.
Mean like someone standard fare here in L.A.?
Well, you know, now it's cell phones. With Chester, it was the newspaper. Yeah. He would read the newspaper and drive at the same time. You know, that Bauer 707, though, it had a big old contactor in it. When you hit the plate, it would scare you to death. It would slam so hard and so loud. And the other transmitters that... Well, actually, to tell you the truth, the 100-kilowatt Continentals that we use don't make as much noise when you turn them on as that 707 did.
Is that right?
Yeah, it lets you know it was coming on. It sounded like it was going to jump off the floor. Yeah. But they had a contactor in there. I don't know. I guess it was just designed for maximum bang, you know. It was a lot of fun. Well, you know, when you first got into this... Did you start out as? I'm just asking. Did you start out as a novice, or did you go?
I don't remember. I think I was a general. I think I went to the general. If you can do that, I'm sorry. You know, it wasn't actually that long ago. I've only been a ham since about 1998.
Oh goodness! I for some reason I was thinking you went back further than that.
No. Was a novice even available then? I don't know. I think I started as a general, but I don't know why I don't remember these things.
But you didn't see that, so then you didn't get exposed to all of the vintage equipment as a kid.
No, other than this Heathkit, as I mentioned, and then I drooled over that catalog and the Lafayette catalogs, and then I saw Collins somewhere, and of course that was beyond any imagination of hope. But no, I didn't see all that stuff until I got into radio, a ham radio in 98. And the reason I got in is I started listening to shortwave again after many years, and I ran across the Vintage Network, the Collins sideband network, and then the AM group, which was near there in frequency. And I said, this is great. I think I'm going to jump into this. I think it's time to get into it. So I basically have two solid-state transceivers. I have a Drake R7, and then I have a ICOM 756 Pro, which is really modern for me. But that's it for, kind of modern rigs. Everything else is tube type, basically.
Well, now, on getting on AM, if a person is thinking about this or saying, I think I'd like to do this, where would you tell them to start? Like, for example, should they try to find a good plate modulated transmitter? A used rig like a Viking 2 or something, kind of give us a lowdown on, hey, I want to get into AM. How would I go about this?
Well, I think that's about right. I would look into something like a DX100 Heath kit or Viking, something in the 100 watt class. There are the Viking Rangers, which are 50 watt, and they're really cute, but that's just not quite enough power to do much good, frankly. So I think the 100 watt class is probably where I would direct people. And like I said, if you're interested in modern rigs, I definitely look at the Flex with an amplifier. If you want to stay modern and are mostly interested in sideband, the Flex will do AM just really well. So I guess that's what I would say. The broadcast rigs are probably only if you really get to be a fanatic and want the big iron around. I would go with 100 watt class.
Now, let me ask this question. What is the normal, I guess I'm going to say, which you'd consider to be, the limit on AM is what? 300 and something? Is it 3? I don't even know because I've never...
What the FCC wants is for your peak envelope power to not exceed 1,500 watts. So if you divide that by 4, you get to 375 watts. The rule of thumb is, or the calculation is, that 100% modulation is 4 times the power of your silent carrier. The peak power of under 100% modulation is 4 times your carrier power. So if you have a 100 watt transmitter, full modulation would be 400 watts peak. So legal limit would be 375 watts carrier. And there's some argument about how, if that really is unfair, because sideband can transmit 1,500 watts, but there is no carrier involved. It's just all talk power. So it's really far more effective than AM running the same peak power. But that's that's an argument that hasn't gone too far with the FCC or anything. But that's what some of us feel.
Let me ask this question, too. This is another thing. You will hear on, and I've heard this, I don't know, repeatedly, from fellows that are on the air, they will complain and go on about AM hams running AM, and, they're just, the bandwidth is, and they go on about the bandwidth, and they go on about the sidebands, and, as much empty space as there is on the 75-80 meter band. And there's a lot right now. I mean, you tune down, and there's all kinds of spectrum. So I couldn't figure out why someone would be so, I guess I want to say, picky-unish about it. But I hear it. So I guess my question is, how much difference is there, bandwidth-wise, between running an AM signal and a single sideband signal? I hear these guys on sideband, though, that are trying to run hi-fi. Hi-fi audio, at least, and I would think that would be just as wide as an AM signal.
Well, I'm not into hi-fi sideband, but the native the filters, unless you change out filters and stuff, the maximum you can get on sideband filtering is around 3 kilohertz. And, you know, I'm not up on the newer stuff, except the Flex. Now, the Flex probably you could set to whatever you want. But typically it's 3 kilohertz. And these the hi-fi sideband people, maybe they're putting, you know, rebuilding their rigs and stuff and widening that. I don't know. But you know, they don't have two sidebands. In IEM, we have two sidebands. We have the carrier, the upper sideband, and the lower sideband. And if we were to limit our audio bandwidth to 3 kilohertz, then we would still be 6 kilohertz wide from upper to lower sideband. So, yeah, we're going to take up more space, but we are... We're interested in quality, and it is what it is, I guess. And it does cause some consternation, I know, with the sideband people. But like you said, there's plenty of bandwidth. I would maybe be in favor of the FCC opening up more general space, because one of the problems is only extra class can use some of that really lower frequency, and if we widen out the generals, then there would be more room for everybody.
Well, that's very true. On AM, one of the things that I've noted, and I think this is worth mentioning, I tuned in one night, and there's a fellow was on talking, and he had built his own PDM modulated transmitter. Mm-hmm. And he sounded, that thing sounded sweet on the air. And as he began to talk about it, one of the things that really struck home to me, and that is, and this has struck home to me several times listening to in the AM window, these fellows seem to be technically skilled at a level far above that of their sideband counterparts on other parts of the band. And I'm not saying that you got to sit and talk technical stuff all the time, but I'm just saying these guys seem to be better schooled than their sideband counterparts. Now, is this an erroneous statement, or do you think this holds a little water?
Well, I'd like to say that that's absolutely true, but let me put a qualifier in there. There's far fewer of us on AM, and we are, I would say, generally more interested in the technical parts. There's many, many more sidebanders, and there are many, many of them are very technical, very sophisticated, but there's just a very much larger pool of people that operate sideband, and many of those are only interested in communicating and not really interested in the technology, and some are extremely sophisticated. So I wouldn't say that AMers are more sophisticated percentage-wise. Well, maybe we are, but we're very interested in the technical parts of what we do, but there's many others in the ham field that are as well.
Well, the reason why I ask is, once again, listening, I'm hearing guys on the air having the type of technical discussions that I remember as a kid. And I've said this before. It used to be, and this is off the wall, but you could get on the ham radio and you could say, well, you know, I've got a Pentax K1000 camera here, and I'm having trouble with this, this, and this. And there'd be a ham would pop up and say, oh, let me tell you how you fix that, you know. Or you may jump in and say, I got a little problem here with my stereo system. I got, you know, something, you know, you might mention something about the cartridge and the tone arm, or, you know, a tape head on a tape recorder. Some ham would jump in immediately, you know, and tell you, oh, let me tell you what the problem is, okay? Now, I guess what I'm noticing is this. Now, even when it comes to computer stuff, I notice that more and more, a lot of guys on the air, I would expect them to be far more computer savvy than what they are, but some of them are not. You know, they're not really RF technically savvy, and they're not really IT or computer savvy. So I don't know where, and maybe that's wrong to expect that. But in listening in the AM window, I hear all kinds of conversations that get started. And
yeah, I think they are generally more technical in the areas we're interested in, which isn't necessarily computers. However, I know one of our AM members or vintage members, he was a very important member of the team at Oracle that developed Java. So that's pretty sophisticated stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I guess that was always cool for me as a young person, being able to turn to ham radio and ask a technical question, and that was like there was a whole pool of teachers out there mm-hmm. that knew so much, and it was just really Now let me ask you this: Are you active in a local amateur club there, or you are?
No, I'm not really. I attended meetings here and there, but sadly not. Hopefully someday I'll have more time to do that.
Well, time is a definite restriction when it comes to things like that. But I was going to ask you, how do you see AM communications, and maybe this is the wrong question, and feel free to tell me if it is, but how do you see AM, or the mode of AM, I guess I want to say, in the realm of emergency communications and jumping in during an emergency?
On amateur radio?
Right, on amateur radio, but also I was going to couple that in with a question, and that is, as you're operating, do you get QSL cards, say, for example, from shortwave listeners? And I would imagine that an AM station would definitely get more activity than a sideband station. But I was wondering if there was any correlation there, or you saw any significance in that.
I know that some say that our older equipment doesn't have chips and things in it that will die in an EMP. So we could get back on the air in theory. That is
true. I've read some reports on that. You know, so I think you're. I think you're hitting close to home there. You get hit with an EMP pulse, and you're still on the air.
Yeah. Yeah. However, I would think, to be honest, getting back on a side with a sideband signal would probably have more penetration, with certainly with less power than an AM signal would. But, again, we'd maybe have a better chance of getting on the air with a transmitter and a crystal mic, you know.
Well, the reason why I ask is this, and that is, you know, take commercial broadcast stations that would be on the air, those that have generator power and whatnot. But a ham station operating AM and with people listening, say, for example, with portable shortwave radios, they'd be able to hear you and understand you.
Well, that's a good point, yeah. Any radio that can receive the frequency would be able to understand us.
That was what I was, I guess I was driving at. I was just wondering, do you get QSL cards from people? Do you hear, or
occasionally?
Friend?
I wouldn't say I personally get very many, but occasionally get some listener reports. Not that many, though, frankly.
Because I was thinking AM, you've got all the little portable shortwave radios obviously receive AM. Very few of them are. A lesser number receive sideband. So mm-hmm. I was thinking that it would be possible for those folks to tune around and hear you talking, much mm-hmm. like happened when you had the tall radio when you were a kid. You were tuning around and you were getting an AM, you know, an amateur radio station on AM. And I had the same thing happen to me with a little Cathedral Gruno radio. I could hear these guys. I listened to 40 meters. And, of course, 40 meters was about as... The whole band was about as wide as the needle that you pointed on it. And, but you could still hear them, you know, and they would be talking about everything under the sun. And then I was wondering, because I thought, you know, in an emergency situation where people are tuning to their, they grab their little radios and they're tuning around, and all of a sudden there's a WJ6W talking, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm thinking, you know, I guess my mind is running in that... in that vein. Well, I don't want to keep you too long here on the radio. We've got we're coming close to being out of time, but in the process of collecting, tell me a little bit about that. I'd like folks who would be able to get on and see this radio studio that you've got hooked up, and you're preserving equipment. You've got turntables there now. Are those Collins turntables that you have?
Yeah, those are Collins turntables. Yeah, I'm a Collins guy. and I have some Ampex audio tape machines, ITC, CART machines, all the big names from way back when.
I was just wondering, but where do you primarily procure these things from? Radio buddies at work at a station somewhere, and you find out that some guy's got a transcription table and...
The radio console, that was actually an eBay find. This console is the model number of the console that was at the radio station I first worked at back in Iowa, and I had looked for one of these for years and years, and I think there must be only a handful of them that's still in existence, but I found one in exceptional condition on eBay, so that was an eBay find. Turntables, other radios, either... the turntables, that was Mike Giroux. He's traded for years in broadcast gear, and he ran across these, I don't know where. Some of the others, the guys have advertised, mentioned them on our EM nets, like a Hammerland receiver and some of the other stuff, and the Ampex recorders was a station getting rid of things. So, it's various places. And as I said, eBay's one of them, although you pay a bit more. A lot of this stuff didn't cost anything, actually.
Well, I was wondering, because you have an incredible collection there, and he's got video running here on Skype as we're talking, and I can see his Giroux meter above his VU meters on the console. And, it all looks just so wonderful. Matter of fact, is there anywhere online, I guess I want to say, that folks could see this studio? Do you have a camera display of this? Or you were talking about the group of guys that you hang with, that you use a web page to display video. So I'm just curious if folks could go there and see this.
Yeah, every Wednesday night we have an AM net. And during that net, a bunch of us get on this site called Tiny Chat, and we put up our cameras so you can see many shacks, actually. And I'll give you the web address of that. It's www.tinychat.com/AMIWest. And that is, we get on the air usually, this time of year, we get on the air around 7 p.m., and then there's a net that runs an hour or two. In the summer, we might get on at 8 p.m. Wednesday nights, West Coast time, tinychat.com/AMIWest. And you can get a look at a bunch of shacks.
All right. I definitely appreciate you giving us that URL. We will we'll post that up on the website. And then that way folks can come up there and take a look. And I'm telling you, folks, this is interesting. What he's got going here in the shack is just really incredible. When the video first came up, I was like, oh, my goodness. Matter of fact, my son David was here going, oh, my gosh, look at this. You know, and that's a beautiful, beautiful Collins audio console he's got there. And, of course, he's got two turntables sitting there that are vintage, that are what you would have seen in a radio station back when I was young working there. A lot of QRKs, and I'm trying to think of some of the brand names of those
I think QRK might have been the one who made these Collins turntables. They didn't make the turntables.
But anyways, it's quite a beautiful setup. We really appreciate you sharing with us everything from the video, as well as talking about AM and folks. I'm sure there's a lot of hams out there that are interested in AM. Some of them on the edge of their seat, maybe a little bit of afraid to jump in. And you've made it sound pretty cool tonight, I can tell you that. So I think you probably have sparked the interest in the hearts of quite a few guys that would want to get into the AM window, so to speak.
And no, thank you. I hope so, yeah.
It's a part of the hobby, folks. I think it's fascinating. Well, David, thank you so much for appearing with us tonight on QSO Live. I really appreciate your company. And you'll have to come back again, because I'm sure at that point in time there'll be a whole bunch more to talk about.
So all right,
all righty. Well, listen, you have a good evening, and folks, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back same time, same station next week for another QSO Live.
It's the CR1A. Now you say, what's the CR1A? CR1A is a software-defined radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this thing does not need a computer. It's totally self-contained. And it's a little bitty toot. It sets on the desktop. It, as far as ham radio is concerned, it does 160 through 10 international broadcast bands. It does 120 through 11 AM single sideband CW. You know, I can't get into all of the features, but for example, on VHF, it goes from 64 to 260 megahertz. UHF from 437 to 512. FM broadcast band. Oh my goodness. You know, I don't want to try to describe this radio. You have to see it. It does the aircraft band. You know, there's a Marine and NOAA. It does the public service bands. It's a software defined radio without the computer. It's self-contained and it's small. It's slick looking. And you just have to check it out. Check out the CR1A. Com Radio. Go to comradio.com. That's C-O-M-M radio. Com Radio, one word, .com. Check out the CR1A. And when you contact them, mention WTWW. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger. But you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from the QSO radio show and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. You've heard us talk about the CC Skywave radio. And the only way you can do this radio justice is you have to hold one in your hand. You have to own it. You have to be able to take it out in the backyard or take it, slip it in your pocket as you travel around. It's a beautiful travel radio. Probably the best travel radio that you could possibly ever want to own. Okay, it's got AM on it, a very hot AM radio section. FM, FM stereo. It's got Weather Alert Plus. It's also got the shortwave bands, 2.3 to 26.1 megahertz continuous tuning. And it also has the air aviation band.
You have direct entry of frequencies and plus auto scan and store. Can you believe that? A lighted LCD display, selectable fast or fine tuning on all bands except weather. There are 400 memory presets on this radio, and it runs on two AA alkaline batteries, all right, and it runs forever. There's a stereo headphone jack and a fold-out backstand. Of course, you've seen those. The clock with 12 or 24-hour format. The alarm that's on it as well. And there's a rotary volume knob, which is kind of cool. I hate the knobs you have to push on them, you know, and turn the volume up and down. It comes with high-quality CC buds, the earphones, and a carrying case along with a one-year warranty. Now, you can order the SkyWave radio right now. To order, all you have to do is call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Or visit them at ccrane.com. You have to mention WTWW. And the reason why we want you to do that is Bob Crane wants to know that you're supporting him as he brings you Midnight in the Desert, the Art Bell Show, as well as some of the music programming we have here on WTWW. Once again, the phone number, 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863. Or go to ccrane.com and be sure and mention WTWW. R&L Electronics. Now listen, go to their website and look at what they've got. Talk about ideas. They've got towers, radio accessories. They have HF radios, VHF radios, UHF radios. They've got power supplies. They've got connectors. They've got coax and cable. They've got books on amateur radio. They've got amateur radio tuners, antenna tuners, I should say, automatic and manual. They've got antenna mounts. They've got all sorts of antenna accessories, along with antennas themselves, and they also have big amplifiers, and they have medium-sized amplifiers, and they've got preamps, and they've got used equipment, and they've got all the major brand names like Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Alinco, you name it. It's all there at R&L Electronics. Now, another thing, they carry used items. Radios that have been previously owned that are in mint condition. They've got the new Yaesu System Fusion Mobile. Their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. Now, I'll give that to you in just a minute. But just remember, folks are happy when they deal with R&L Electronics. They're great on service. They're courteous. They get the item out quickly to you. And if you have any problems at all, these folks are right on top of it. Now, once again, their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. 1-800-221-7735. Or go to Google and just Google R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. And mention WTWW when you call. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Now, don't be frustrated with Wi-Fi. That's one of the most frustrating things I think you can face when you open up your notebook and you're getting ready to do something and the Wi-Fi's flaky. You know, it goes and comes. It doesn't seem to matter where you position your notebook. It just won't happen. Well, you can solve that problem and turn Wi-Fi reception into a pleasure if you get the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3 from the Sea Crane Company. Now, that's right. It significantly boosts your Wi-Fi internet signal. Significantly. And the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna from Sea Crane will help improve the entire Wi-Fi picture for your computer or laptop. Now, this thing can detect a Wi-Fi hotspot hundreds of feet away. It can boost the internet signal to keep your connection strong. It's made for indoor or outdoor use. It's water resistant. It can be mounted up high for best reception. I mean, like up on the roof. It plugs into a computer or a laptop via the USB port. So not you're not messing around with little connectors and things like that. It's easy to install the software that comes with it, and it's an experience. It will change your Wi-Fi experience forever. Now, to order the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3, call Sea Crane now at 1-800-522-8863. That's 800-522-8863. Or visit them at seacrane.com. Now, mention WTWW, and we ask that you do, because that keeps the Art Bell Show on shortwave. If you love art on shortwave, then place an order with Sea Crane. Let Bob Crane know that you're patronizing their great company. Once again, boost your Wi-Fi signal. Get rid of your Wi-Fi frustration with the Super USB Wi-Fi Antenna 3 from Sea Crane. Now, those phone numbers, once again, 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And mention WTWW. For those of you that would like a shortwave radio that's bigger than maybe what you could hold in the palm of your hand, but yet is sensitive and selective, let me talk to you about the CC Radio Shortwave. The purpose of the CC Radio Shortwave was born when an engineer's time went into producing some of the best reception and audio that you could find in a portable radio. It's got all the necessary things, the tweakings available for excellent performance under various conditions, and offers the best combination of sensitivity, selectivity, and audio performance of any radio its size. Now, this radio delivers some of the best FM reception, and thanks to the built-in twin-coil ferrite antenna, the AM antenna I'm talking about, it makes the AM on this radio absolutely exceptional. It has continuous coverage of the shortwave bands and excellent reception right off the whip antenna. The 5-inch speaker is accurate, pleasant, and probably produces deeper bass than any portable of the same size. The CC Radio Shortwave is one of the few radios with a mono switch. When activated, the radio filters out the stereo FM multiplex signal, which can add a hissing noise when you're listening to a weak station. Now, let me tell you, this thing has an RF gain control, bandwidth control, fast and slow tuning. It's got bass and treble controls. It's got a lighted LCD display and lighted buttons, clock radio, snooze alarm. It only weighs 4.2 pounds, even though it's a pretty good size radio. Has a stereo headphone jack, stereo line output, so you can plug it into a recorder of some sort. It's got an IF out for input into a computer, 50 memory presets, a built-in charger with auto shutoff for nickel cadmium batteries. It uses 4D batteries or 4AA batteries, whichever you prefer, and all the programming backup, that is, for, you know, when you put in your memories and whatnot. You can order this radio from the Sea Crane Company. It's real simple to do. All you have to do is call Bob Crane at 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. And mention WTWW when you order this radio. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Well, that's all the time we've got for the QSO Radio Show this week. We want to say a special thanks to our guest, David Jennings, WJ6W. Want to invite you all to come back next week, same time, same station, or wherever you're listening, to another QSO Radio Show. This is Ted Randall saying 73s.